Welcome to this episode of the My Journey as a Physicist podcast. Each episode features an interview with a physicist to learn about their work, their interests outside of physics, and their professional journey of how they ended up where they are today. Season 2 features physicists involved in the particle physics planet community known as Snowmass. Hope you enjoy today's episode. Welcome, Meenakshi Narayan. Could you briefly introduce yourself? What is your current position and job?
Yes. So first of all, thank you for the opportunity for introducing myself and talking about my work. I'm Meenakshi Narayan. I'm a professor at Brown University. I'm also an experimentalist at the CMS experiment at the Large Hadron Collider, where I do most of my research work.
Okay. Can you describe what your research areas or focus are?
So I am an experimental particle physicist. That means that I look at really fundamental particles and study the interactions. And for that, I look at the very early universe and how the universe came. The structure right now is probably reflective of what fundamental particles and interactions were at the beginning of the universe, just right after the Big Bang. So we basically, in laboratories, we try to create the energy or the environment right after the Big Bang to understand the various particles which possibly would have been at that time at the beginning of the universe and how they interacted. And we create this in the lab to understand what we see right now and how it's related to what it was there at the beginning.
Okay, very nice. And so with your research, you said you're experimental. So do your experiments, or you spend most of your time at Brown? Do you actually visit on site at CMS, or where do you do like most of your work?
Yeah. So the CMS experiment is a large multipurpose experiment located at the CERN site and where the Large Hadron Collider, which is an accelerator, which is situated. And it's one of the CMS experiment is one of the four experiments at CERN, and CERN is located in Geneva, Switzerland. Basically, CERN is at the border of sort of straddles between Geneva, Switzerland, and nearby French regions. So it's at the French-Swiss border. The CMS experiment is actually on the French side, and it's on the 0.5 location of the Large Hadron Collider, the accelerator collision and points. So there are actually four big large purpose experiments, and one is CMS out of them. Our competitor experiment is ATLAS experiment, which is on the Switzerland side. And then there are two other multipurpose experiments, ALICE and LHCb, which are very focused experiments also at CERN. So on the CMS experiment is a very large experiment. It is a global collaboration. And what we do is we build detectors at CERN as well as other global sites. One of them is Brown University, where we are actually have built sort of previous tracking experiment, parts of the tracker detector, which I will come to later, of the CMS experiment, which is one of the components of this big, large, multi-purpose, five-story detector, which weighs a couple thousand tons. And we build very small parts, but very intricate parts of this detector, and we install it there at CERN. And then we collaborate with a huge number of institutions and scientists and engineers worldwide to collect the data, bring the data back to Brown University, a subset of the data, and then our students analyze it here. So our group is basically split between residing at Brown, building detectors, analyzing data, as well as part of our group members are at CERN in Switzerland, at operating the detector, working on making sure that the data coming out is of good quality, and also helping collect the data. And then there is also another site, which is the Fermilab, which is in Illinois in the US, and that is the host site for the US part of the CMS experiment. And our students can also work at this host site at Fermilab or the US CMS experiment, collecting data and learning how to collect data and collaborating with people within the US in analyzing the data.
Very interesting. And so then you mentioned how these projects vary in scale of like teams and collaborators. Like how much, how big is the team that you work with on the type of work that you do?
So it varies by the projects, the size of the team. And so for instance, if I am doing an analysis, which is very particularly focused, For instance, one of my interests and my group's interest is to look for very rare production of multiple top quarks. Top quarks are the heaviest known fundamental particle to date, and it's one of the six quarks, and the sixth quark and its anti-quark was discovered in 1995 at Fermilab. And the way it was discovered was in the production where the top and the anti-top quark are produced. However, there could be two of those top anti-top quark pairs which can be produced. It's a rare production process, and it has not been seen until now. And this is a process which I'm looking for with my students and my postdocs and our group. And I collaborate with three other US institutions, as well as two other European institutions. So even though the CMS experiments has around 160, 170 institutions over 50, 60 countries, our collaboration within that large collaboration is really limited to a number of six or seven universities and within their students and postdocs and the professors. So our collaboration is about 20 people or so, on which there are five or six students doing various part of the analysis and the decay of the four rare top quarks production into various different final states.
Yeah, that's really amazing. Collaboration just everywhere.
Yes, the collaboration is everywhere. So that is kind of the analysis part. Building the detector is yet another collaboration we have. So as I mentioned earlier, we are part of the tracker collaboration. That means we are building detectors which look for the trajectories of charged particles as they are produced in the collision. So when a proton and the proton collide, then there are lots of smaller charged and neutral particles which are produced in this collision, which could be directly produced in this collision as well as from the decay of other particles, which are heavier particles produced in this collision. So one of the things to do is to really very precisely measure the trajectory of these particles, charged particles, if we can, because from there we can figure out if they're sitting in a magnetic field. Simple physics tells us that if a charged particle goes perpendicular to the magnetic field with a certain velocity, then it gets curved depending on its charge. So it may curve clockwise depending if it's positive or counterclockwise negative. And the amount it curves in as a circle, that curvature is proportional to the momentum of the particle which was produced. So by measuring this curvature or the trajectory of the particle as it's flying out perpendicular from the collision, if we can do that precisely, then we can get very precise measurement on the type of the particle, the momentum of the particle, the charge of the particle. And this is basically key to all the measurements. So this type of measurements are made by building, right now, there's a lot of devices made out of silicon, just like, your chip in your iPhone, but we use them, the silicon, in a very different way to make these charged particle detectors. And they could be pixelated, they could be strip-wise, they could be different geometries, basically. And we work on them. And these collaboration could be, since we have to make a huge detector work, right? This could be over many countries and many people, but our local groups are about 10 or 15 people there. So these are very different kind of collaborations where also engineers and other technical people are very necessary to work with our students and postdocs, whereas for the analysis, it's more people who are type of data scientists or actually physicists or scientists are working on it. So the nature of the collaboration, whether you're building the detector or analyzing the data, could be very different and the sizes could be very different.
With your work, do you find that you are split between analysis and equipment stuff evenly? Do you spend more time with one versus the other?
Okay, so at my stage, when you are a senior professor, more of the time goes into the management, unfortunately. And the rest is, I would say, split between analysis and hardware. But I think more of my time goes into the hardware part and more of the technical part, because that's where you're looking a lot more to the future. Whereas the students and the postdocs who are currently, trying to get their PhD or to the next step of their career also have to focus a lot more on the analysis part and publication part, because that is also very important for their career. So they can, while I can have the leisure of spending a lot more time on hardware compared to analysis, they have to split it equally. So I find myself doing a bit of more of management than I would say working with the equipment and hardware, not as much as I want to, but brainstorming with people, of course. I get very little time to stand in the lab and actually do the measurements and things myself, but it is also talking to the people, brainstorming with the group, trying to make sure that everything is there and works well together, and we are keeping on schedule and on budget, etc., while providing the intellectual contributions to the experiment. And for analysis, I meet with my students. I barely run any analysis code these days. I basically rely on my postdocs and students and other members of the group and critique the plots and brainstorm with them more that way. So I would say that, yeah, it is at my stage of life, I think it's very unevenly spread out, my contributions through this over analysis of publications and hardware.
Yeah. Have you always enjoyed building things, you know, your entire life?
Oh, yes. So I have to say I stumbled into experimental particle physics and became an experimental physicist when I came to the US. So my initial education was in India, and I did my undergraduate and my initial master's program in India. And then when I came to the US, I enrolled in Stony Brook University, which is on Long Island, for my PhD program. And there is where I really found my love and passion for experimental particle physics, because being educated in India and not at one of the very big universities, there was very little limited equipment and available to play with. And also with equipment, you had to be very careful because they were very expensive and you couldn't break it. And if anything happened, you know, you were really felt guilty that the next person would lose their chance in doing the experiment. But when I came to Stony Brook and I had the freedom to really explore what my passion was, and there was no issue about, you know, finding equipment, building things and exploring and doing what I wanted to, I found that I really liked being an experimental particle physicist. And that also, you know, took away some of my inhibition in terms of saying, oh, I shouldn't be touching this because this is very expensive equipment, and what if I break it? My professor, Juliet Lee Franzini, who was also a trailblazer herself in her times, she said, oh, if you don't break a few things, then you're not a good experimental particle physicist. And that really, you know, made me feel at home. And I said, okay, I can really learn in this environment. I can grow in this environment. And I found that I really like to do particle physics experiments. I like to tinker with equipment. And that's where actually I found my real self as a graduate student.
Yeah. I remember the few labs that I've worked in were actually like building stuff. It never fails. Like, you know, at least me, I always felt like I broke things a lot. Is there like a moment that stands out to you as like, oh, I had this mistake that I then overcame? Or was there like, oh, a proud moment that you're proud of like, oh, I built this thing and it worked, that stands out to you?
Yeah, there were many smaller moments, which at that time, if I look back, they're much, much smaller than what I would say now, but they were actually very important because it helped me gain my confidence, right? It's just making very small tabletop experiments work, measuring things which were very simple at the time, but they worked, and I could see the correlations between various results and the data, and just the pleasure of having go from zero to getting a signal actually helped me become a particle physicist. I can't say that there is a big thing which I actually did which really stands out in making me a particle physicist, but my confidence was gained through a series of smaller achievements, I would say.
Yeah. And then, so like, I know you're involved with the Snowmass, you know, community. Can you kind of describe what your involvement is with that?
Oh, definitely. So with the Snowmass community, so Snowmass is a study, which is a community study, which is initiated by the Division of Particles and Field of the APS. And here what happens is every 7 to 8 years, the entire community comes together to figure out where we are in the field and how we can make progress and come together we cultivate a vision for the future. And our future, basically, for particle physics timelines, currently in the snowmass, which was started in 2021, we are curating and thinking about a vision which starts in 2025 for our field and then goes over the next 10 to 20 years. So we definitely would like to have a plan coming out for the 10 years beyond 2025 and then have a vision for another 10 years after that. And this is what we did in 2013 as well. So the plan we are following now was kind of created in similar studies in 2013. So in snowmass, as a community, when we come together, our community of particles and fields is very large. So we got divided into 10 so-called frontiers in the community. And these is very broadly speaking by different types of interests. And one of them is called the energy frontier. That means where the energy of the collider or the energy of the experiment matters most. And this energy frontier, I'm one of the three leaders of this energy frontier study. And in this energy frontier study, what we are trying to think about it, what are the next set of colliders beyond what is already running or have been are scheduled to be operating until 2040. So after 2040, 2045, what type of colliders should be operating? That means we have to start building those colliders or have thought about what to build earlier on. So to give you a sense, currently we have the Large Hadron Collider where we are doing the experiments. And the next step of the Large Hadron Collider would be the high luminosity LHC, so that the Large Hadron Collider itself will not change, but there will be upgrades to it, which will increase the luminosity. That means the rate of collisions of the proton-proton in them by a factor of five or so. And that means that we will have very large data set, which we will collect. That large high luminosity Large Hadron Collider, as we call it, HLLHC upgrade of the LHC, will start taking data possibly maybe 2027 or so because some of the COVID delays. But and then we will take data until sometimes for 40 or early late 30s or early 40s or so, depending on what we see. And so now after that ends, what do we do, right? That high luminosity LHC will give us a lot of data where we can study the properties, the precision properties of the Higgs boson. And so what would be the next step after that? Depending on what the Higgs properties show us and tell us, or if we see new particles, what can we do beyond it is what we are thinking now. What are the different types of experiments we can mount? What we learned from the Higgs in the HLLHC era, how we can refine it even more to figure out where the energy scale of the new physics is. The mass of the Higgs boson has been very perplexing, this 125 GeV, which was great. We found this about Higgs boson about 10 years ago on July 4, 2012. And now this low mass, as we call it, of the Higgs boson sort of indicates there is something else which is going on. There are some new particles or new forces and interactions which have to exist. And this is the hint we are getting from the mass of the Higgs boson, which is light. So if you study its properties in even more precision in the HLLHC, it may give us some more insight into where the mass scale of this new physics lies, or what should we be looking for next. And this is the kind of colliders we are looking for after the HLLHC, which we generically are calling Higgs factories. That means we have to go into colliders which give us millions of Higgs particles, not hundreds of thousands. So the Higgs factories which are being proposed are supposed to give us a couple millions or tens of millions eventually of Higgs. So it will start with a million and then a few million Higgs particles, which would help us measure the properties of the Higgs boson more about factor of 5 to 10 more precisely than what the HLLHC will leave us with. And so this is one of the big things about the snowmass, is to understand what type of Higgs factories we want to make, what should be the properties, how many Higgs should be producing, what should be the luminosity, what should be the energy. And then there is also the technology, which the accelerator frontier is talking about. And then what type of detectors we want to build so that we can really measure these properties as precisely as we want. And then there is this other, one way to look for things is by measuring the Higgs properties precisely. The other way is to look for new physics is to produce it. That means we need colliders with even more higher energies, right? And so we basically, so if you want to look for 10 TeV particle, then we produce, then we have a collider which has the center of mass energy of say 100 TeV, and in the direct collisions of these protons at 100 TeV center of mass energy, then maybe a 10 TeV particle will show up directly. So that's another way of measuring. So there are very high energy, what we call the beyond the standard model discovery machines, which we are talking about. One of them is this very high energy proton-proton colliders at 100 TeV. Then there are other colliders called the muon colliders, which don't have to go to 100 TeV, but they are very multi-purpose colliders, you can call them. So you can start at an energy at 3 TeV up to 10 TeV in the muon collider center of mass energy. But while muon colliders are a little better in electron compared to the E plus E minus Higgs factories in terms that their beam doesn't have Bremsstrahlung, but muons decay. So that's another one of the problems we have with the muon colliders. But this study of the muon colliders have been going on for multiple decades. And by now, we know that we have technology where we can build upon some muon colliders. And so the R&D for the muon colliders, for colliders which could be after the Higgs factory, need to start as well. So we have kind of, you can think of two pathways. One is the Higgs factories after the HLLHC. So that's one of our vision. And then after the Higgs factory, what do we do to a direct BSM collider, whether it's a muon collider or whether it is a high energy proton-proton collider. So those type of R&D needs to take place. And so the community, the SNOMAS community, is coming together to form these visions. So it was a very long explanation, but hopefully it gives you a sense of what SNOMAS is all about.
Yeah, and for sure. And so what has your involvement meant to you, being a part of this community?
Yes, this has been really very, I think initially when I started, I was a little bit apprehensive because it looked like a very challenging job, because there are so many ways you can carve out the future, and many, many people have many different ideas. And so bring the community where we can all discuss all our ideas plus a consensus emerges is a really daunting task. But I think over the last 2 years, we have learned how to communicate with each other, what is important in the physics. And so for me, that has been quite a learning experience, and also helped me feel very enthusiastic about being part of this study where I could really make a difference in terms of charting a future course, even though there could be multiple paths one could take. It's not really clear exactly one path one can take, but we have to have some plan where we can always have a backup plan as well, right? So definitely emerging the fact that the Higgs factory is the next thing after the HLLHC has been quite exhilarating and quite rewarding for all of us to recognize that as a field, and then an R&D towards some other BSM collider that is also very nice thought which is emerging. And for me, as personally, I find that being part of this process, being part of making sort of carving out a vision with my colleagues in a consensus way has been very, very rewarding and a big learning experience for me too.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, no, I'm just amazed by the scale of everything. And as you said, trying to get everyone to agree or at least feel like their voice is heard in this is definitely a complicated thing.
Yeah. So for the scale, which you said, if I may chime in here. So while I'm saying that, we have this Energy Frontier group, it itself has, so I'm running this group with two of my colleagues, Laura Arena, one from Florida State University, and Alessandro Tricoli from Brookhaven National Lab. But within this group, we have 10 other subgroups. So with each one of these subgroups have at least two or three conveners. And each one of the groups, they are based on Higgs or electroweak physics or top quark physics or strong interactions or beyond the standard model physics. And so we couldn't have done without the help of so many people, right? This is a very large field, and we really needed the help of everyone in this group. And to have a very coherent participation by everyone has been really very refreshing. I was a little bit hesitant about how this will go, because it's a large group, and it's, in LHC, basically half of US particle physicists participate. And so half of the US particle physicists in SNOMAS community are almost, if I may, a little bit of exaggeration and bragging here, but are in the energy frontier. So just to give you a scale. And so it was a little bit unnerving in the beginning, but just to see that everybody came together, these 10 subgroups are navigating themselves in a coherent way and also helping us carve out this future vision is, as I said, very refreshing to all of us and has been very, very helpful for the field itself. So I have to thank a lot of people here for making it possible, and especially many of the young scientists who have been participating through the studies in these subgroups, students and postdocs, and who have been very energetic because it is their future.
So Kat, going back into your career journey as a physicist, if you feel comfortable doing so, can you share like any obstacles that you may have had to overcome along the way?
So basically, as I mentioned earlier, that most of my undergraduate education was in India. And then I did my master's also in India before coming for my PhD to Stony Brook University. In my journey to becoming a physicist, there were a couple of, I would say, different transitions I had to make. One was I did not know that I wanted to be a physicist when I was in high school. All I knew was I really liked math. And this meant that in high school, in the school I was, which was a co-ed school, and there was no math track in high school. In India, there are different tracks. Math was more with the engineering track. So I had to transfer to another school, which was an all-girls school, which I felt like, why would an all-girls school have a math track and no other ones? Because I guess there was a visionary principal in that school who decided she had many students who loved math and she created a math track. So I think that was a really nice environment. I found myself flourishing with my passion with math. And then when I went to for my undergraduate, I basically concentrated on physics and statistics because by that time I realized that I really wanted to do that. Growing up in a family with a lot of multi-generation of lawyers, when I was wanting to not follow being the track of becoming a lawyer or an engineer or a doctor, right, the usual stereotypical tracks, my parents were a little worried as to what I will do. But then I was a daughter, the eldest daughter of a big clan in an extended family. So they weren't that worried because the primary goal would be get her education and get married off, her off somewhere, and that would be fine. But after I wanted to do my master's in physics, they got a little worried, and my father and my mother were really, I would say, very forward-thinking people for their time, but being in a very big family, they also felt the traditions had to be followed. And so when I said I wanted to apply for further studies for PhD, and especially in the US, there was a whole family meeting which happened with my father's brothers and in-laws and whatever, right? All the men of the family got together to figure out whether I should do my studies versus I should really concentrate on, my parents should concentrate on getting me married off. Of course, my parents, whatever they did prevail and said, no, she wants to do physics or whatever she wants to do, let her do it. And so that was a big hurdle, right? And I have to be really thankful to my parents that they saw the passion in me, that what I was passionate about, and they made me provided me the opportunity to pursue what I wanted to do. And then when I came to Stony Brook, then I realized that, as I mentioned earlier, I wanted to be an experimental physicist, and from there I really grew. And I have to say, my PhD program during those few years where I was getting data and doing analysis, building detectors for my thesis, the environment of the lab was very, very inclusive. My professor, you know, at the time, Professor Juliet Lee Franzini, having herself, you know, being one of the senior women in particle physics, have herself gone through many of these ups and downs of being a female in particle physics, really kept a very, very nice and inclusive environment in the lab. So I didn't really feel any difference, or none of her female students felt any difference from any other person in the lab. We got the same environment, and it was really, we flourished, I have to say. But after that, when I became a postdoc, that's when I realized what the real world was for a female physicist. And there were some ups and downs, and they were learning experiences, I have to say. At the time, I used to get very bothered about it. And I was young, energetic, aggressive. I'm still aggressive, I guess, people tell me. But you have to be, like, sometimes say that being a female physicist has made me schizophrenic. I can be very nice and very collegial if you trust me, but if you don't, then I can be very aggressive. So, you know, you have to figure out which part you will get things done. And that shouldn't be so for anyone, right? You should be yourself, and you should be just in a nicer environment. And I think things are changing for, hopefully for the better, for our colleagues and for the next generation. And just like it was changed for me from my professor, sort of every generation it changes, not as fast as we want to change. But yeah, there are hurdles and we all have faced in one way or the other. Just like, you know, examples being, you have an idea and you talk about the idea to somebody and as a postdoc, then a third person would come back to me and tell me about my own idea, having rephrased that person X was talking about this idea. And you say, well, I talked to the person. So, you know, and then those things don't bother me. I have a big thick skin now, but I shouldn't be saying that because that's not a very good way of being persuasive to other people from underrepresented groups to be welcoming into physics. But I think we all have a responsibility to make a difference. And this is, I've learned from the situations presented to me. I tried to use them as an example to make things better for my students, for members of my group who are underrepresented, whether from minority groups or whether they are females or any group, right? We should not be differentiating between anyone. Many of us, you know, compared to others, I've grown up with privileges of different kinds, and I also recognize that. Those privileges, which many of my students don't have, and we all have to, if we can just keep recognizing that, things would be better. So yeah, I think I turned your initial question a little bit around, but both of them have to go hand in hand as to the hurdles which made me a physicist I am, and hopefully we can do better for the future generations.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. Sort of wrapping things up here a little bit, we had talked about how your role in mentoring students and supporting students in these spaces. Do you have any advice for students or young researchers from either about pursuing a career in physics?
Yeah, so pursuing a career in physics can be challenging, and we shouldn't let those challenges overcome our passion, I would say. If you're passionate about physics, then your career will follow and your passion will come through that. But sometimes the challenges which are posed in front of us demoralize us and take away from our passion. But I think, so what I would advise a younger generation is to just once in a while, step back, make sure why you are in physics, what drives you, what makes you wake up every morning thinking about a problem. And if you still do that, then, and if you do that and that is physics, then you're still passionate about physics, no matter what is in front of you for the day, and you will make it. And really the successes are defined, our own successes are defined by us. If we put a barrier which is really high and which is somebody else's barrier or threshold to judge us, then we may never achieve them, right? It is our happiness and our passion are both correlated, and those will have to be defined by us. What makes us happy? What makes us passionate about something? And we should define our goals by ourselves on a daily basis if need to be, rather than let somebody else define it for us. Because if you let somebody else define it for you, then you'll lose confidence. You may not measure up to that. But we're not here doing physics trying to measure up to somebody else's goals. We are here because we like it. We like solving problems and we are happy about them. And we like that challenge and we like that intellectual problem to sit there and spend hours and figuring out how to solve it. That's what makes me tick. So I would say people should figure out what makes others tick, right? In the end, that's what it is you have to be passionate about. So that's one thing in careers building. And the other is never forget, for me, I will never forget that where I am is because due to some of my mentors, how they gave me advice, how they played as a role model for me, And I always think about at times, what would X do if they would be in such a situation? So always think about what advice you've gotten and what advice you will give to somebody, and always give back to the community in terms of mentorship or other acts of kindness. Sometimes, mentorship can be difficult depending on where you are, but on the other hand, you may be able to give to the community in various different ways. So just find what how you'd like to give back and what makes you really wake up every morning, get out of bed and do the thing. And for me, it is physics, and hopefully others in the younger generation feel the same way.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you for sharing, and thank you for coming on and talking about your journey as a physicist. It was great talking with you.
Thank you for inviting me on this show. So thank you very, very much.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. This podcast was created by Brian Stanley and Professor Wei-Win Lin. Season 2 was edited by Varley Sakorikar. Thank you for listening.